Thank you. it's ready at this time.
All right. Could I do the roll call, Christina?
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
We have yourself, Margie Millen, Jeff Newman, Edmund Chung, Peter Olson, Michael Palage, Yun Ju Min, Avery Doria, Liz Williams from the staff, and Victoria McKevedy. We have apologies from Tim Ruiz, Philip Shepherd, and Kelly Smith.
One of the things that I don't know if everybody's had a chance to take a look at the agenda that I circulated late last night. Apologies for the delay in doing that. But one of the things that I thought might be helpful to talk about, at least at the outset, is whether there was an interest in meeting during the Lisbon meeting, assuming that we can coordinate everyone's schedules. I personally think it would be helpful, but again, I'd like to see what the consensus is.
Christina, it's Liz here. I had set aside some time for the various working groups to meet at the face-to-face at the Lisbon meeting.
Oh, excellent.
So, Pardon me. I think that the face-to-face time, as Abby will attest, and the Los Angeles meetings a week and a half ago were very, very useful. So if the group wants to go ahead and do that, Ben and I need to sort of slot that into the other groups that are meeting. And I think the Febo 6 group will meet for a couple of hours. The new TLDs group will definitely meet. The Who Is group will meet, and the Reserve Names group will definitely meet. So, and there is many.
The IBN group will meet.
Exactly, and there's lots and lots of overlap. So, Glenn, perhaps you could advise Christina sequentially what we could do, because people are going to have to go from one to another rather than run things at the same time, because there's too much overlap between the groups.
Right.
Would that be possible on the Saturday and the Sunday, Liz?
Don't you think so, Glenn? I think it has to be then.
It has to be, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could perhaps give me preferred times, we could start working on that.
Well, speaking for myself, logistically, I don't expect to even be available in Lisbon until late Saturday afternoon. So I don't know to what extent I can move that flight. But
okay, well, we can perhaps slot you in then for Sunday.
Does that conflict with any GNSO council meeting?
When's the GAC meeting, Glenn? Because that's another one.
The GAC meeting is at lunchtime on Saturday and just after lunch on Sunday, so it's from about 2 to 3, 4.
Is anything currently scheduled for Sunday morning?
Not as yet, hard in stone.
Right.
Church for me, Christina. Not. Sorry. I couldn't resist. Sorry.
Can we say 2 hours?
I think that probably would make sense, because I think probably I would hope at that point we're at the point where we can really start getting into the meat of the qualitative analysis and working out the outreach to the constituencies in a more formal way. I mean, that's what I'm hoping that we could accomplish at that point, if not before then. So,
Christina, I just looked at your mechanism summary forms that you'd sent around today. Presumably you want something meaty to continue your analogy to discuss at the meeting. What were you expecting to do with those forms then?
With the ones that I've circulated today?
Yep.
Honestly, at this point, it's really just so that we've got one consolidated, easy-to-compile source of information about all the protection mechanisms, and essentially in a format that it's going to be easy to identify commonalities, to identify variances,
yep, sure,
that type of thing. I mean, that is really more of a mechanical idea, and you're absolutely right. It's really only intended to cover the very procedural part of the mechanisms and not into the qualitative analysis, and obviously we'd want something different for the qualitative part.
I don't know how far, what progress you've made with people volunteering to do respective things, but because I unfortunately have not been able to make the call previously, but where are you, just perhaps you can give me an update with that, where are you up to?
We've allocated all the working group members, all of the TLDs that we'll be looking at were allocated to working group members last week for responsibility for preparing the summaries, and once we get into the more qualitative role of it, kind of taking the lead with regard to those. We spent a fair amount of time last week talking about at what point do we start reaching out to the constituencies, what's the best way to do that, what is it that we're looking for from them at a very, very high level. I mean, obviously not in very detail at this point. The idea being that at this point at least, members should start talking with their constituencies informally about what they anticipate their ultimate views will be in terms of some of the more qualitative aspects.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, I personally, my understanding is that, let me ask you this, Liz, the compilation of all of the subcomponents of this that will go into the bigger report, is that handled by staff?
Yes, it is. And fortunately, the February 6th report has gone off today, and I think that this is the trouble with having multiple elements of work going on at the same time. It's actually quite difficult to be working on multiple things at once that rely on each other. So if I got a sense from the group about what they expected to do with those reports, then I should take it on and fill those charts in, because we need to look at everything across all of the registry agreements as they stand, but that's a big piece of work to do.
Well, exactly. And that's why we were assuming that's why the working group members were going to handle the actual completion of whatever they decide on.
Okay. And when can that be done by, do you think?
My understanding was, and again, anyone on the call who recalls differently, please pipe up, but my recollection was that we anticipated having that completely finished before Lisbon.
Okay, so we've got 2 weeks before Lisbon, which sounds terribly close. What help does the group need? Because I'm sensing that it's a very big task and the group needs some help.
I honestly don't know what help people need. I think at this point this is a good time for anybody on the call who needs
to speak up. No help. I'll take the silences. Everything's fine then.
And the only thing that I can think of that we may need help on as we get a little farther down the line is, and actually perhaps at least initially, there are some quantitative factors that we'd indicated in the statement of work that we would look at that may not necessarily be readily available information.
Yep, exactly.
In terms of kind of overall number of registrations, kind of registrations, that type of thing. But I would expect that, and again, please, anybody who needs assistance, speak up. I would expect that everyone's able to identify the relevant policies and mechanisms and the like.
Okay. So just go ahead and just let me ask who's doing what on the basis of your summary documents those templates that you sent out today. How's it being divided up? Like, who's doing what?
That was in an email, a post-meeting email I sent around last week.
Sure. Is everyone that's... I read it, and could we just quickly recap that? Because it's really important that we understand what we're doing for the Lisbon meeting, like how much time we need to apportion, what we're going to cover, and then what we need to get finished between now and then.
Sure. In terms of responsibility for essentially filling in what was identified in what as 1C in the suggested outline for the working group, we had allocated the TLDs as follows: .arrow Frank, .biz Mike P, .cat Audrey, .coop Victoria, .dk Peter, .eu Margie, .info Jeff, .jobs Mike R, .moby Tim, .museum Kelly, .name me, .pro Lance, .se, Avery, .travelme.tvpeter and .usjohn.
Super. So that means that a couple of people have got two, but most people have only got one.
Correct.
Okay, cool. So is there any hesitation there that before the next call next week that work wouldn't be completed?
I have no reason to think that there shouldn't. I mean, it really comes down to, you know, do we care whether we have a consistent format or not? I mean, I would vote yes, but...
I care very much. I care very much because what we've done all the way through the new TLDs process is to collect information in as consistent a format as possible to enable us to compare things.
Right.
And it's very, very important to be efficient, especially this late in the process. And we've done that on public comment periods. We've done it on collecting information about terms of reference. We've done it on terms and conditions of contract. We've done it on all kinds of different ways. So I'd hope that we don't diverge from that too greatly.
All right. Then the question becomes, does anybody have any additions, changes, questions to the forms that I sent around? As I indicated in the cover email, I tend to do these things in table format simply because it's easier for me to see them graphically. You know, the downside to working in tables in this way is that you end up coming either very long or very short for space constraints, and that this might be something that we would not want to do in a table form, but essentially use the same category headings. Does anybody have any strong feelings one way or the other, preferences, other ideas? No? All right. In terms of, and again, I just really broke the forms down mainly to keep, you know, without having to have something that would be kind of 5 legal pages, I guess American 8.5 by 14 pages rather. In terms of going through the forms, I don't know if everybody has got them, if everybody's looked at them. They conform pretty closely to 1C in the statement of work, starting with TLD eligibility, in which we would identify in that category whether there were any eligibility requirements for the TLD in the first instance. Obviously, if you've got a sponsorship, a nexus relationship or geographical connection, as in with .us or .eu, that type of thing. The next category was really just a very shorthand, you know, off the top. Obviously, we're not going to be able to fit all of the round pegs in the square holes, but if to basically categorize the mechanism in one of 4 ways. Either it's a sunrise type, an IP claim type, something else, or there was no such protective mechanism. Next category would be the rights basis requirements. What did you have to have? Did you have to own a trademark registration that issued on a national register that issued by a particular date? Could you have an application? Could you have a common law right? That type of thing. The next category is really dealt with submission process and submission cost. And the submission process would really just walk through what was required. In terms of moving on to the application verification authentication, that was really going to what happened once the application was submitted. If you're talking about Sunrise, was there a verification of the actual ownership of the registration, if that was a requirement of the validity, that type of thing. Turning next to challenges, whether or not there was a challenge mechanism, just on a very simple yes-no, the next column dealing with, you know, what was the cost and who was the arbiter of that. Finally, the challenge mechanism requirements in terms of, you know, summary was really intended to go into what the challenger needed to show in order to prevail. Turning next to the number of challenges, and then a column getting into the successful challenges, both in terms of an overall absolute number, and successful I mean that the challenger succeeded in obtaining the registration. Maybe that's something that we want to circle back and define.
Yeah, particularly for the .eu, there's a lot of bad guys out there who are winning.
Right. Well, what I was hoping we could do, Peter, is just run through all these and then circle back.
Okay.
Go through to the extent that we have questions, and I know that I had some just while I was putting these together. Successful challenges also on a percentage basis. total number of registered names overall for the TLD, number of mechanism registrations slash claims overall. Well, I guess overall is something we can talk about as well. And then just to indicate what materials the author referred to in compiling this, whether it was information found on the registry website, whether it was information that may have been put together by a participating registrar, whether it was information in one of the proof of concept reports submitted by the registry, that type of thing, with the idea being that you would provide both the name of the document and insert a link to it so that it would be easily accessible. But Peter, I do think that there are definitely categories in here that we should talk about in terms of what we mean by this, and in some cases, do we want to put date cutoffs, that type of thing.
Right.
Going to what I categorize as Part A, does anyone have any questions about that or have any suggestions or points of clarification that they'd like to make?
This is Peter in Copenhagen. I think it was very very clear to me when you ran through it. I must admit that it wasn't that clear when I read it the first time.
Okay.
But so, I mean, things about the TLD eligibility, you know, was it based on geographic or sponsorship or whatever? That would be a helpful, like a footnote somewhere or something.
All right. What I may do, or actually what would be great if somebody could volunteer to do, would be to put together kind of a one-page cheat sheet of, you know, to the extent that there is concern or anybody articulates a comment to the effect that, you know, the headings on themselves at face value may not necessarily be clear, this is what it's intended to cover. Could somebody do that? Please?
This is Peter in Copenhagen. I could give it a shot, particularly if I get the MP3 file of this meeting.
Sure, sure. And that's posted just generally, Glenn, right?
That's correct.
Okay. In terms of mechanism type, does anybody have any questions or comments or concerns or want to add clarifying information for that? Okay. Is there anyone who thinks, and again, I was really just pulling this in large part off the top of my head, are there any other categories that we should have? I mean, is other an adequate category? Is none? Is there another way that we would want to identify that? You know, perhaps make clear that none is excluding the terms of the registration agreement and the UDRP?
Well, this Peter in Copenhagen, in Denmark, one of the ones that I'm working on is we had an auction.
Right.
Which was part of it, but that would be other.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is Inge from WIPO. For .mobi, a new process was introduced, namely that of premium names, and that I would suppose could fall under other, but you may also wish to consider specifying it separately.
The premium names, did that, and I have to confess I don't know, did that deal with names that were corresponding to IP, or was it really just premium names because they were the names that movie thought was most valuable?
Well, the list itself was
based on generics.
Right, but there was a procedure whereby trademark owners could request registration of those names in that list.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I will make a note. I believe Tim is doing .mobi, and he's indicated in his apologies that he actually would be circulating something later.
Okay.
So I'll just make a note that we might want to follow up with him about how to include that.
Unju, this is Mike Pelage. Has WIPO completed all of those Sunrise challenges? Premium names, yes. I'm sorry. Yes.
Premium names have been completed. The Sunrise challenges will probably be completed in about 10 days or so.
Okay. I was just looking at the premium name list last week, and I think there were still a couple pending, so thank you for that update.
And maybe I could also use this occasion to offer any assistance that I could provide with regard to the TLDs that WIPO provided Sunrise Mechanisms, namely .info, .biz, and .mobi. If the persons responsible need any specific information, then I would, I'll be very glad to oblige.
That would be great. Thank you very much. The next category was write BASES requirements. Does anyone believe we need some clarification or perhaps refinement of that?
Can you say that one again? Write BASES
requirements. I know it's kind of awkward. I couldn't really figure out a cleaner way to do it. The idea there is that, you know, to the extent that the protective mechanism required the claimant or the person seeking the entity seeking the benefit of such mechanisms to demonstrate that they were entitled to them by virtue of the ownership of particular rights, how that needed to be done.
Can you give an example?
To the extent that, for example, let's just say for .mobi, that you needed to provide information, that you needed to own a national trademark register and a trademark registration of national or
community
that issued by such a date that, you know, and your name corresponded exactly, that type of thing. And obviously to the extent that there have been TLDs that have taken a broader view in terms of, you know, above and beyond national registrations and certainly to the extent that, and I guess this is a point that I was thinking about, for example, and Jeff, are you on the call?
Yep.
All right. One of the things I was thinking about is where do we want to put in, you know, because one of the key points in the IP claim process was essentially the fact that anybody going ahead with the registration in light of the IP claim essentially had to acknowledge that.
Right.
And, you know, that doesn't really, we don't really have anything in here that would deal with that. And I'm wondering where
I think
you would suggest we should put that.
I would put that probably in the submission process.
Okay. All right.
I mean, because, you know, and then the rationale used in .biz was there was no need to verify that you owned it. It's, you know, it's, there's no verification of an IP claim. Anyone can file the IP claim, but it's up to the applicant to actually look at the claim it receives
right. And
evaluate it for itself to see whether it's got any merit. And then it needed to say, yes, I've read this claim, and I still want to proceed.
All right. Do you think maybe that for the purposes of, I hate to say conformity, but for ease of reference later on, do you think maybe what we might want to do is put application, maybe revise that application verification authentication so that it would also encapsulate where the verification was required to be done by the applicant above and beyond the actual submission?
It's more of an acknowledgement rather than a...
Okay.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of an acknowledgement rather than a verification.
All right. So that we'll leave that in submission process then.
Yeah. And Mike Calais is writing this up, so he'll do a good job with that.
I'm so glad you have that vote of confidence, Jeff. Well, what happens is we have Unju is the backup there to make sure that everything's accurate.
All right.
Thank you, Michael, for that.
In terms of submission process, I was thinking not so much kind of the mechanics, although I guess we could get into that if everyone thought that was relevant. Not so much kind of the mechanics of, you know, you have to submit it through a registrar, da-da-da, but I was thinking more along the lines of, you know, you had a three-month window to do it in, you needed to submit this information initially, and upon further request, be prepared to provide the information in, you know, verification, authentication column. Unless we think that there may be some unique aspects of some of the submission processes that it might make worth singling those out. Anybody?
I think it's right. I think we should compare the time periods for submission.
And I would also include in that to the extent that there were requirements that the application person or a claim be submitted by someone who had a particular nexus to the whatever IP right was being asserted. That's where that type of thing would come in as well. Commission cost is pretty self-explanatory. I guess the only question would be where there was a two-step in the case of .eu and to the extent that there were others. Were there additional costs for the verification for .eu? Or it was all at the front end, right?
Right.
Okay.
Well, usually there's two types of costs, right? There's cost for the processing of the verification, but then there's also TLDs required a minimum registration period of a certain number of years. Some of them did. I'm not sure if all did. But, like, if you registered in .us, for example, you had to commit to a five-year registration.
Okay. Then I think that's definitely relevant. Turning now, well, before we move on to Part B, we can name it anything else that anyone would like to name it. Any other questions or comments about the first part of the form? All right. Application verification authentication process. This was really intended to really get to kind of two things. First, to what extent it was done, if at all, and if so, by whom and what it entailed. So, for example, to the extent that a registry would really spot check, that type of information would be included here. Conversely, if it was every single one, you had to, if it was .eu, for example, you had to submit that to everything. That type of thing. Any other clarifications or points we would want to put in there?
This is Peter in Copenhagen. This kind of has to do with the previous column as well. But one thing that was, I think, sorely lacking with the .eu was the fact that there was no fix-it period. There was no mechanism whereby if there was a just a minor problem with some of the documentation, and if you remember this .eu, these people, PricewaterhouseCoopers, they wouldn't accept it if it was stapled. I mean, they had all kinds of loops that you had to hop through, among other things, that they couldn't staple the things. And so if there's anything that went wrong, the 40 days was passed. And then as part of the ADR, the UDRP type thing, afterwards, a lot of people tried to file these things, tried to fix them, and they weren't able to do it. And so my question is, has there been any other experience with these validation type things where they've been so strict as under like .eu, or was there a dialogue between the validation agent and the applicant where they could, you know, file additional documents within the a certain time period to fix the validation?
I don't know the answer to that.
No.
But I do think you in your question raises a good point, namely that I think what we may want to do is add kind of another category for just other comments. And I certainly think that it would be worth noting that, for example, for .eu, that the verification requirements were interpreted and applied, you know, extremely strictly, or, you know, obviously something a little bit more grammatically used than that. But because I think that's important to note, and I know, you know, in some cases, as much as for example, I personally would like some registries to have verified whether in fact somebody did have trademark registration number 123456. You know, the other end of the scheme is .eu, where there's such strict interpretation that. Again, you know, I can certainly understand both arguments for that, but I think it's worth noting simply because to the extent that we're trying to identify are there best practices out there, that may be something that we want to consider in our recommendations. Challenge mechanism, yes, no, that's relatively straightforward. The cost and the arbiter, and when I say cost, I mean filing fee. I'm not talking about time required to prepare the challenge, that type of thing. And again, I guess in some cases it should be arbiters. Challenge mechanism requirements to prevail. I had a lot of questions about how to phrase this in a way that was clear, but I'd be interested to hear what others thought we should be doing with this.
Are you talking about the standard of proof here?
I'm talking about if I want to challenge, if I'm somebody who didn't get, and let's just, I hate to pick on .movie, but if, I'll just pick it's the most recent one. If I was someone who filed a Sunrise claim, Sunrise registration application for a .movie name, and I didn't get it, and I think that the person who did get that name is not entitled to it, under the policy that's been put forth by the registry, what do I need to show to win that challenge? And I realize, Peter, you had brought up a comment earlier about people who might not otherwise have been perceived to have been entitled to challenges are winning them. And I would rather that we not get into kind of qualitative, but I mean, for this part, I would rather we not get into that type of qualitative comment. This is really just more of, you had to show A, B, C, and D. And the first person to file the challenge was the first challenge heard, and if they won, that was the end of it, that type of thing. And similarly, Jeff, if I'm remembered correctly, in the IP claim process, it was really the first party, the claim that was identified as first, and I forget actually how that was ranked, that party had the first opportunity to challenge.
We actually did it. We randomized it.
You randomized it.
Yeah.
Right, but ultimately it was ranked. I mean, it was listed in terms
of...
Yeah.
So five people submitted claims, who randomized the five people, and then whoever was listed as number one had the first opportunity to challenge. If the tie period passed, it went on to number two, et cetera.
Right, okay. Yeah, I mean, that type of thing absolutely would be included in there. Number of challenges, here's the question that I had is, I don't know whether it matters whether we make a distinction. I know I was initially thinking, well, do we want to put a time period, a cap on that? But to a certain extent, the Sunrise Challenge period or the IP claim, the stop process, I mean, those all had built-in time periods. Is that right? With the exception of .info.
They did, yes.
Okay. So then maybe we don't need to worry about that, because if we start trying to go beyond that time period, then we start getting into, do we need to be taking a look at UDRP proceedings, and that's just a road that...
Well, I think even with Biz, it took longer than a year, because it did... maybe that's right. 21 days. Yeah, a year is probably about right.
All right. Then that would certainly be worth putting in for whoever's doing .biz and maybe other comments. Resolution of all, not proceedings require, took 1 year from launch or however the appropriate wording is. Do you all think that's helpful information to have?
I think it would be helpful. Mike Rodenbaugh.
All right. Peter, now we get to successful challenges. This is where you raised your question. Maybe should we rephrase that so that it's challenges won by the challenger? Does that make it clearer?
No, I was... .eu is really weird. That's what I'm having the most recent experience with. It's because there's a whole lot of challenges against the registry,
right,
in the first one, and those are basically being mostly won by the registry, and then in the trademark challenges, these are getting won by the bad guys who, typically if it's the trademark owner, against the rogue trademark owner, then the rogue trademark owner wins.
Because they had a legitimate, so-called legitimate claim of right, you mean?
Right.
And they in fact won in the lottery or in the
Well, they came. They were the first one. Yeah, they were in the land rush between the two trademark owners.
Right.
They were the first one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do we want to? And that kind of brings up another point in the sense that that type of date cutoff could clearly go into right basis requirements. But do we want to create? Do you think we need to create a separate column that would indicate? Or separate field, category, whatever, that would indicate whether the date cutoff was tied to, and I think it's usually tied to the initial agreement with ICANN, is that right?
Yeah.
Edmund, the date that you all picked, what was that? I know it corresponded to something, and I'm forgetting what it was.
You mean the date that the, for example, like the date that the TLD application was published?
Maybe that's what it was, right?
That's what it was for...
Okay.
Or that's what's proposed for .asia anyway. I'm not sure what all the other ones.
All right.
Hey, Christine, I mean, what happened... I'm sorry, Edmund, finish and then I'll go.
No, I was just speaking to muted tones, but... the dates picked were the... one was for the submission of the original proposal, and one was the signing of the contract.
Okay.
We provide different priorities to different dates.
Okay.
Christine, this is Mike Plage. The original date used in the affiliates.info date was the date that the application was made public via ICANN. So
okay.
That was their attempt to prevent gaming.
Right.
Unfortunately, as we've seen in other scenarios, is that was kind of a one-off solution, and it's been kind of hard to hold back the gaming since. In connection with .mobi, .mobi originally proposed an original date as set forth in their application. However, as a result of a delay by ICANN in processing their application, they actually pushed back the date, if you will, to a point after actually the execution of the contract, but prior to the, if you will, influx of Benelux registrations. In connection with their premium name challenge, what they did there was not, they actually required a certain period of, if you will, bona fide use of the mark. So there was a couple of different, if you will, triggering dates in connection with the protection right mechanisms involving the .mobi process.
All right. Do you think, do we all think it's helpful to note those to separately indicate what those dates were and what they were tied to? Would that be helpful? Or are we just at the point where everybody who was going to game the system did it with a Benelux registration until the use requirements kick in, they're just going to continue to use them?
The benefit of trying to go and dig document each of the specific dates, I don't know the value of it. I do think it is important to note that registries have, if you will, shown some flexibility to alter the dates based on a number of concerns to, one, protect gaming, but I would say first and foremost is also to protect the rights of the community. Specifically in .mobi, one of the things they were looking at there was there was a lot of people that had entered into the mobile space after their original application, and the fact that it, if you will, drug through ICANN's process for about 18 months, provided somewhat of, a potential disadvantage to members in the community. So I think there are multiple reasons why dates switched to both serve the community and potentially mitigate potential gaming. So that's the problem, I guess, I have with trying to read too much into the dates. There may be various reasons why the dates were there, and it may be I would recommend just sort of a summary of the different dates, not try to, if you will, create a comprehensive list that I think would be of limited value.
All right. So more of kind of a, registries have used the following date cutoffs corresponding to the following events, X, Y, Z, A, B, C, that type of thing.
That's what I would recommend. Just keep it at a summary level.
Yeah, no, I think, the more that I think about it, trying to go for each one and each date, giving me a headache thinking about it. All right. Then we get into the two columns that I actually had the most questions about myself, and that is total number of registered names and the number of mechanism registrations or claims. And I guess one of the things, I mean, what this was intended to get at was to what extent are the registrations within a particular TLD occurring purely for defensive purposes by, you know, IP rights owners. In the sense that if, for example, you know, the closer the ratio is, then I think it's reasonable to think that one reason for that is that the TLD is being used, is viewed by IP rights owners as relevant primarily for defensive purposes. So I guess the first question is there any reason that we wouldn't want to have that type of information? And then the next question is, if we do want to have it, do we want to use a date cutoff in the sense of, do we go from the date that the TLD launched to the present? Do we use, you know, from 2 years? Do we pick whatever the most recent registry was to launch and kind of do 1 year from that date? There's a number of different ways to look at it, and obviously whatever date you pick is going to affect the outcome.
Mr. Bowery, can I ask a question?
Sure.
I don't understand how you can tell that.
Yeah, this is Mike Cleage, if I could get in the queue after Aubrey's done speaking.
I mean, for example, I don't know what the criteria. I look at, for example, the Dot Catalan Sunrise, and the things they're giving Sunrise positions who have nothing to do with previous right holders, but have to do with, are you a university? Do you speak Catalan? Are you one of the people that supported us? Things like that. So I don't know what criteria, what absolute notion of criteria could have that would allow us to ferret that out.
I guess this is, are you done, Aubrey?
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay, thanks. This is Mike Pelage. If I could build on it, I guess my concerns there are is, one of the things that we discussed previously are defensive registrations where one trademark owner wants to potentially block another trademark owner securing a domain name. So in that sense, is defensive, you know, how are we going to begin to sort of categorize those types of situations? I just think it's very dangerous from a methodology standpoint to actually read into specific numbers. Again, I'm just some of the numbers that I've been putting together, or if you will, just extracting from the .biz summary, was there were 2.4 million domain name applications that were received. Now, out of them, there were, according to this, there were 862,000 in which there was no IP claim, and there was there was no IP claim, and they were eligible for domain name selection. There were others where there were cancellations. I mean, it's just very hard to read into what is going on without actually talking to the registrants one-on-one. Now, what would be helpful, though, and I do think you are trying to get to an important data point here, would be potential trademark owners providing their own statistics. You know, Mike Rodenbaugh, who's on the call, you know, him and I have had this discussion before where, you know, upwards of 97% of his marks are purely defensive in nature. So those types of documented records, I think, would be very beneficial as opposed to reading the tea leaves from numbers that may or may not be an accurate basis. So,
Mike, I completely agree with you that we should try to do outreach to trademark owners and figure out those statistics. But we also should have the raw numbers from the registries to at least take a look at and compare.
Mike, I'm not
IP claims there were, for example,
And put it this way, Mike, those numbers are in my draft report right now that I was reading from. So I'm going to give you all the numbers you can, but I think what I was just trying to caution was what Avery had started to say. You know, you know, what are those numbers, and, you know, does one look at them and say the glass is half full or the glass is half empty? It's if in fact we're talking about defensive registrations, you know, it would help to know whether those companies that were seeking to register, you know, were they aware of other people that had similar rights in a mark? Christine, even you yourself, I think at the beginning, you know, part of the service that you provide some of your clients is the ability to navigate them through these things to secure their rights. So that's what some of the good lawyers do, recognizing that there are multiple parties that sometimes have the same rights to the mark, perhaps in different classes. So that's to me part of what I think is very important.
Well, but I think I agree. I certainly agree that we shouldn't be trying to read the tea leaves. And I think in some cases we don't necessarily need to do that. And in some cases it would be especially inappropriate. For example, in the example that Aubrey was giving, I mean, if for example the protection mechanism registrations were really not focused towards prior rights owners, well, then I think you can take from that if it was, for example, if they were one of six categories and they were fourth in the queue, I don't think it's necessarily too much of a stretch to say that there weren't really that many defensive registrations there. And again, obviously you'd want to go to the trademark owners. I guess another way to look at it is, and I don't have some strategy report, but I had thought that somebody had taken a look at to what extent registrations, in particular TLDs, were resolving to websites that were A, active, and B, unique from whatever the website owners.com or other quote-unquote primary registration was. And I don't know that those numbers are available TLD-wide. Is that right?
I know some, put it this way, I mean, what you would basically be trying to do, I think what you would want to do is look at those names registered during the trademark period and just look at a subset of how those names are being used. I mean, I know, you know, I think a lot of registries do track for internal purposes, you know, what the potential usage of, you know, there's the names may be in the marketplace. But as far as trying to break that out of a subset of names that were registered 5 years ago and whether that does or does not apply, I mean, you know, just look at some of the companies that were in business that are no longer in business. And we're not talking just small businesses, but some large multinational corporations that have gone bankrupt. So try not to pick on. Don't know if anybody represents them or, as I said, the former employer of ICANN's chair of the board. So what happens is again, what I'm trying to do here is make sure that when we get our data set, that we have a data set where we can make some really good determinations. And you know, these numbers, Mike, as you asked, you want numbers, you're going to have numbers. But with regard to having data that I would feel comfortable making more solid recommendations or determinations, you know, this is something where somebody's going to have to come, you know, Mike and other large brand holders like themselves coming forward and saying, you know, I don't, you know, I do X percentage defensive registrations or something like that. I don't want these and nobody else has a right to these marks or something along those. That to me is a much more concrete foundation that we can make recommendations.
Sure.
So that's what I'm just trying to do, look ahead to make sure our work isn't undermined at a later point in time.
Right. No, I think that's a good point. And I, if I remember correctly, I think I have an Internet Committee meeting on Thursday. And maybe one thing that just picking up on that, you know, maybe we could get INTA to make available an online survey for its regular members, the trademark owners, to say, you know, how many domain names corresponding to your major brand have you registered, and you know, to what percentage of those are, you know, associated with active websites that do not replicate, you know, whatever your primary website is. I mean, and that sounds like the type of quantitative data that you think would be valuable to have.
And the only other qualification I would add would be, in determining defensive, you know, if only a legitimate trademark owner could have rights to this, would you still go ahead and register it? Because I do think there are, companies. I mean, I just on the GA list, there was a posting that I think Newstar won one, lost one on the UDRP or something like that. I saw that on the GA list.
Hey, thanks for bringing that one up. Thanks.
Well, you won one, right?
There were special circumstances in that case, and
okay. Well,
don't put him on the spot.
Put it this way: Mike and Jeff, they're my friends, and we each put each other on the spot. And I'm not trying to put them on the spot. But
let the record reflect that they did a bait and switch on us.
Noted.
But what I am trying to articulate is that. Just because someone says it's a defensive registration, if someone says it's a defensive registration, I think it is important to note, you know, is there someone else that may have rights in that particular mark?
And
Apple Records, back when Apple Records and Apple Computers were, if you will, in disagreement, they would both view themselves as having rights, and, you know, one might view the other as a defensive registration. That's
so
the point I'm trying to articulate.
Rights claimants, not rights holders, I mean, all the way through.
I mean, it's a claim to rights, it's not a having rights, so even a defensive, you don't know that the person actually has rights, they're just claiming them.
Fair comment, yes.
Except we can go back to the Sunrise periods where those rights were verified in some respects, right?
Well, but, you know, and I think Mike Palais might be thinking of the example that I gave him. I mean, I can tell you that it was very important to me that I file the very first .mobi Sunrise Challenge for AAA.mobi on behalf of my client, the American Automobile Association, to make sure that we beat out the American Arbitration Association.
Right.
You know, those, so yes, I mean, in a way, that's a defensive registration for us, but in a way, it's not.
Yeah,
because it is, in fact, something that AAA wanted and is planning to do.
Yeah, and as I said, Christine, there's the Deltas, there's the Acmes. It's not the purpose of trying to articulate this is not to put any one company or their clients on the spot.
Right.
It's just trying to, if you will, make sure that there's some depth to the numbers that we're looking at and say that there may be a basis for some of these defensive registrations. And I think having that fair and balanced analysis is really what the more we do with this working group, the longer I think the better chance of legitimacy of the output of this group will be when it goes to the council and, if you will, potentially to the board as part of the overall new TLD and other processes they're working on. So I just want to get it right at the beginning.
Oh, no, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think the only thing that leaves us with, then, is references, although I do think... I'm sorry, Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Peter in Copenhagen. I just wanted to add one thing about the last column there.
Sure.
And certainly with the .eu, we've got a lot of good numbers. It was like 180,000 Sunrise applications, and now there's like 2.6 million. So there's some good ratios there. But the one thing that was interesting, I think it at least deserves a footnote with the .eu somehow, is the fact of these generic Sunrise applications. I would call them bogus trademark registrations. I mean, for .sex, there was like 281 Sunrise applications for .sex, you know, also based on, you know, various kinds of trademarks. So I think that of those 180,000, it was probably at least 100,000. A vast majority of them were related to generics, trying to abuse the Sunrise system.
Well, what I think maybe we might want to think about doing to provide us kind of with more, I guess what I'm thinking is I think we should certainly include a section for, you know, other comments or remarks. And I think to the extent that we include information like that in our TLDs, that we do so on a very general level in the sense of, you know, picking up on the example that you just gave, Peter, making the observation that, you know, a number of Sunrise registration applications were filed for, you know, what are often considered to be generic words, you know, and give an example. I don't think we necessarily need to try and extrapolate what percentage it was or how many of them were all total, but I think it's certainly worth noting that.
Okay.
Because I think, you know, that certainly comes into to something that we should be thinking about as we move forward. I know we're at time. I don't want to keep everybody. But I guess the very last question that I would have is, does anybody have strong feelings one way or the other as to whether we keep at this table or basically just turn it into a Word document and you just use each of the column headings as a section heading? What's going to be easier for everybody? I'm sorry, Aubrey.
I find filling in tables easier.
Okay.
So one voice.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I also like the table approach.
Okay.
Me too.
All right, excellent. Then I guess, Peter, if you wouldn't mind kind of circulating the glossary or the cheat sheet, once you've had a chance to listen to the recording, that would be great. Is it real? What I'd like to do, unless anyone thinks that it really is just impossible, is for everyone to be at least in a position where they've got an initial draft of their chart or charts for their TLD by next call. Does anyone think that's unrealistic? Right? Then that's what we'll do.
A draft, but likely we may not, obviously won't have statistics from the registries many cases.
Right.
Have it drafted and sent out to the registries by the next call would be a good goal, I would say.
What registries do you have, Mike?
I only have dot jobs.
Okay. That should be easy for you to get then.
Yeah.
If they didn't have any.
mine will be easy. Yeah. Others will not be nearly as easy.
N-A.
But I'm going to take some hard stuff later, I promise.
All right. Actually, that raises a good point. I mean, do you think it makes sense to, is there any reason that we couldn't just each person as necessary reach out to the relevant registry? Jeff, what is your sense as to how people would like to be contacted to the extent that we can't locate the information anywhere?
I don't think anyone will mind. I'll send a note out to the registry constituency list. I think, you know, a number of them are on this task force and the others that aren't. They were supposed to all, I think there's reporting that they were all supposed to, at least the initial ones were supposed to indicate all of it in reports anyway.
Okay.
But I'll send around a note to the registries and let them know that people will be contacting them. And in fact, if you could send me that list again of all the people that are responsible, I could send that list directly to the registries and they'll know who's going to contact them.
Sure, absolutely.
I'm going to be looking into the .se on the FD on the CCTLD side, so I'm not sure how easy a time I'll have with that. But
all right. Well, let us know if there's anything that we can do. Let me just make a note. And
sure. It'll just be interesting for comparison to see what happens.
The last question, just circling back to the meeting in Lisbon. Now, when I said Sunday morning, I wasn't thinking like 7 a.m. Is that kind of where people were thinking we were going to be? Glenn, Liz? I know.
9 a.m., is that all right?
I'm, you know, now that I have a toddler, I am a morning person now, but I will defer to everyone else.
So it's 9 a.m. on the Sunday before the meeting starts. Okay, the first Sunday?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the GNSO, Liz, excuse me, Glenn, you said the GNSO and the GNSO and the GAC you said 2 to 4, correct?
Yes, about that time.
Have they made a determination whether that's open or not yet? I know the GAC had a call today.
I'm not sure if they've made a determination whether that's completely open, Mike.
All right, thanks, Glenn.
All right. Well, as always, thank you, everyone. I really appreciate all your work and participation, and I will send a quick recap email out. And in the meantime, you know, feel free to post any questions, comments, references, that type of thing.
Great.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.